we get too far into that, though, I do need to tell you about my old buddy Mitch Fowler. Mitch is a big guy. Like, tall, wide, big dude. And you never have to wonder what Mitch is thinking. He will tell you. Usually the very first thing that pops into his mind, appropriate or not, is going to come bellowing right out of his mouth. And the only thing redder than Mitch's hair is his neck. Okay? Now that you've got the full picture, Mitch, oh, and by the way, his whisper could be heard across town. I have no idea why we thought this would work. But now, coming up on 23 years ago, when Christy and I were getting married, Mitch was one of our ushers. What was I thinking? I like look through the window into the sanctuary as he's ushering people, like walking in front of them. I'll sit over there and turn around and walk back. I'm just like, oh my word. I'm so glad Christy can't see this. Otherwise, she would flip out right now. But that's my buddy Mitch. You know, for all of his faults, he did have one that I found to be a little more obnoxious than the rest. Mitch seemed to have this gift, if we'll call it a gift, to zero in on someone's most singular act of stupidity and forever memorialize that with a nickname. In Mitch's eyes, everyone became known by the dumbest thing they ever did in the form of a nickname. And it got to be kind of old. Got to be kind of obnoxious. When most people would say, Mitch, knock it off. You know, that's not who I am. This is my name. Do you think that stopped Mitch? No. He just kept calling people by this stupid nickname that might have been deserved. Definitely not wanted. But a lot of times, it just narrowed somebody down to this one thing that they weren't exactly proud of. Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what Mitch calls me. I'll just leave you to wonder about that. But anyways, it actually wasn't that bad. Why am I bringing this up today? Well, the first follower that we're looking at today, closing this series out, has a nickname. A very undeserved nickname, really, that encompasses one singular moment in this guy's life. Thomas. And now how many of you just filled in the blank with his moniker? Doubting Thomas. By the way, some of you may be keeping tally in your mind thinking, wait a minute, isn't there another first follower that we still have to cover? Judas Iscariot. I did mention him last week, worked him in when we were looking at Simon the Zealot. And I had to ask myself, what life lessons can we really learn from Simon the Zealot? Don't sell Jesus out. Nothing's more valuable than him. There you go. Okay. Plus, trying to build a whole sermon around Judas Iscariot, trust me, it can get weird. Okay. So we're closing the series out today with a look at Thomas and what we know of him. And admittedly, if we just looked at the Synoptic Gospels, what we know about Thomas, not much. He's only mentioned once in each one of the Synoptic Gospels, that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They only use the word Thomas one time, each one of them. And it's in a list of the other disciples. That's it. So like Philip from a few weeks ago, we have to look at the Gospel of John. John includes a few stories about Thomas, and that's where we really get a picture of who this guy really was. And so let's look at the first one of those stories that John includes. And we find it in John chapter 11. If you want to turn there, the live event's also up and running on your phones and tablets. In John chapter 11, starting in verse 1, a man named Lazarus was sick. He lived in Bethany with his sisters, Mary and Martha. This is the Mary who later poured the expensive perfume on the Lord's feet and wiped them with her hair. Her brother Lazarus was sick. So the two sisters sent a message to Jesus telling him, Lord, your dear friend is very sick. But when Jesus heard about it, he said, Lazarus' sickness will not end in death. No, it happened for the glory of God, so that the Son of God will receive glory from this. So although Jesus loved Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, he stayed where he was for the next 2 days. Finally, he said to his disciples, let's go back to Judea. But his disciples objected. Rabbi, they said, only a few days ago the people in Judea were trying to stone you. Are you going there again? So now Jesus' disciples are justifiably nervous about him going to Bethany, where Lazarus was, because it wasn't that long ago that they were almost successful in capturing and executing him. And so that's why the disciples are all kind of trying to put the brakes on Jesus, going, wait, hold on, let's think this through. Last time we were close to there, you almost died. So why do we need to go back there again? Especially when Jesus just told them, no, it won't end in death. So they're all thinking, okay, he just needs like a shot of penicillin or like an ibuprofen or something, and he's going to be fine. No big deal. Why are we now going to risk death to go to where Lazarus is? But that's when Thomas is introduced to us for the first time down in verse 16. Thomas, nicknamed the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let's go too and die with Jesus. So first thing right off the top of that, John uses the Greek word didymus. So what does that tell us about Thomas? He was a twin, of whom we have no clue. There's no mention of a brother or sister, but apparently he had one, and they were born really close to each other. Does that matter or mean anything? Probably not. But that's what one thing that we know about Thomas. What really tells us about Thomas's character is that statement. Let's go die with Jesus. Boy, he's a really cheery fella, huh? I mean, he's assuming the absolute worst, right? I have to believe Thomas was a bit of a pessimist, always looking at worst case scenario. Because now he's been with Jesus for a while. Things have been working out pretty good, right? He's seen some amazing things. Jesus is saying this isn't going to end in death. It's all going to be okay. But now Thomas is saying, well, if we go there, what's going to happen? Yes, he narrowly escaped being captured and executed before. It won't happen twice. Of course, Jesus won't make it out of this one alive. Let's go die with him. The pessimistic Eeyore worst case scenario approach. That's one way of looking at it. Of course, you know that. I'm an eternal optimist, Pollyanna. Yes, this pessimistic guy, Thomas, is assuming the worst. But what does it also say about Thomas? It's better to go die with Jesus than to be without Jesus. There's a level of dedication and loyalty there. Doesn't matter what may come, I'm going with Jesus. I'm going to stay by his side no matter what. Really, none of the other disciples declare that kind of loyalty, with the exception of Simon Peter. But Simon Peter's dedication and loyalty lasted a few hours until he got questioned by a little girl by the campfire and then denied even knowing him. But here we have Thomas saying, yep, if we go there, Jesus is going to be captured. He's going to be executed. Let's just go and die with him, because I don't want to be apart from Jesus. He was so dedicated and so loyal to him that he couldn't bear the thought of being away from him. Which really brings into perspective the next time we encounter Thomas in John 14. John 14, chapter 1, Jesus is speaking. He says, don't let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God and trust also in me. There is more than enough room in my Father's home. If this were not so, would I have told you that I am going to prepare a place for you? When everything is ready, I will come and get you so that you will always be with me where I am, and you know the way to where I am going. No, we don't know, Lord, Thomas said. We have no idea where you are going, so how can we know the way? So what's the question behind the question there? Jesus is saying, I'm leaving, I'm going away, you'll know where to find me. And Thomas is saying, no, no, we don't. I need to be with you, so give me the GPS coordinates, Jesus. Give me the map. I need to be able to find you, because he can't bear the thought of being away from Jesus. And again, pessimistic outlook, I'm not going to know. I can't figure this out. I need it spelled out for me because I can't bear the thought of being away from you. So give me the map. Please, Jesus, don't trust my brilliance to be able to figure it out. Tell me exactly how to find you. But really what Jesus was doing here is just giving them all a glimpse into God the Father's plan and letting them know that Jesus would soon be departing. But Thomas just can't accept those statements because he doesn't understand. He doesn't want to be apart from Jesus, but he also doesn't have a context and he doesn't understand what Jesus is actually saying to them in this case. He wasn't challenging Jesus at all. Not like, again, Simon Peter rebuking Jesus for, you know, telling him, you are not going to do that whole dying for all of mankind thing. How dare you even suggest that? That was a rebuke. Jesus smacked Peter back into position there. Thomas wasn't challenging Jesus. He was just being honest about the fact, I don't know what you're talking about, but I need to understand. Help me understand. So I think really this is what reveals the greatest trait about Thomas. Yes, he was pessimistic. Yes, he assumed the worst. But above all else, he was sincere. He didn't fake anything. He wasn't just going to nod his head at what Jesus was saying, even though he didn't understand. He was sincere. He was authentic. That word, sincere, is actually very interesting. There's a lot of background to that. Excuse me, it comes from the Latin. Sincere from the Latin is two words combined, sincere. In the Latin, it literally means without wax. Without wax. Because what would happen in the marketplaces, like if you were a clay potter and you made water jars or whatever the case was, if there were cracks in them and you didn't have morals, you would coat it with wax to make it look good, to hide the imperfections. But if you had a clay vessel, a jar, whatever, that had no cracks, you would stamp it sincere, without wax. What you see is what you get. No fakery, no hiding anything. What you see with your eyes is exactly what you are getting. It is sincere, without wax. Thomas is sincere. He's not willing to fake anything. He's not willing to hide his questions and just go along with it, even if he doesn't understand or doesn't even agree. We all, every single one of us, is more practiced in insincerity than we think. Think about the question or conversations that you have with people. How often do you just kind of nod along? Some of you are doing it right now. Hopefully you're agreeing with what I'm saying, but how often do we do that? When we think the other person is a blithering idiot, but we just don't want to challenge it at that moment in time. So that's an interesting perspective. That's insincerity. And yes, every single one of us is guilty of that. Thomas is just simply refusing to nod his head and go along like all the other disciples who didn't understand what Jesus was saying either, but they're like, makes perfect sense. Yeah, okay, yeah, sure, absolutely. We'll know where to find you. They didn't have a clue. Thomas was the sincere one who stepped up and said, no, Jesus, give us the map because we don't know where to find you. These guys are going to say that they will because they're too afraid to step up and be honest and sincere, but I can't stand to be away from you. So give me the directions. You know, and we said a couple weeks ago, whenever Jesus is challenged, he challenges right back. When he gets rebuked, he rebukes back. So we know the quick litmus test for is this a challenge is what Jesus says in return. Again, Thomas is not challenging Jesus by saying, no, we don't know where to go to find you. We don't know how to find you. We don't know where you're going. That's not a challenge. It's a sincere question born out of a sincere desire to be with him. Because what Jesus says in return is, I won't even say arguably, it is the most powerful, profound statement on his mission that he gives us, period. In verse 6, Jesus told him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me. That's not a rebuke. That is a bold declaration that honestly we don't have time even in one day to unpack everything that statement from Jesus means for all of human history and eternity. But that was not a rebuke back to Thomas. That was a bold self-declaration about who Jesus is that came as a result of Thomas's sincere questioning of Jesus, his desire for more information. And then finally, the last time we see Thomas in John's gospel is the one where he gets that bad rap. John chapter 20, down in verse 24. One of the 12 disciples, Thomas, nicknamed the twin, was not with the others when Jesus came. They told him, we have seen the Lord, but he replied, I won't believe it unless I see the nail wounds in his hands, put my fingers into them, and place my hand into the wound in his side. 8 days later, the disciples were together again, and this time Thomas was with them. The doors were locked, but suddenly, as before, Jesus was standing among them. Peace be with you, he said. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here and look at my hands. Put your hand into the wound in my side. Don't be faithless any longer. Believe. My Lord and my God, Thomas exclaimed. Now, before we go down the road of Thomas's doubts, let's be intellectually honest about the other guys in that room. Thomas was not the only one who had a track record for doubting what they had heard, especially when it came to the resurrected Jesus. In Mark chapter 16, verses 10 and 11, after Jesus rose from the dead early on Sunday morning, the first person who saw him was Mary Magdalene, the woman from whom he had cast out 7 demons. She went to the disciples, who were grieving and weeping, and told them what had happened. But when she told them that Jesus was alive and she had seen him, they didn't believe her. So here you have these women go to the tomb on the first Easter morning. Jesus not there. They see angels. He's risen. He's not here. Go tell the disciples. The women go and tell the disciples, and the disciples say, nope, don't believe it. But Thomas gets the bad rap. Well, let's continue on. Mark 16, verse 12. Afterward, he appeared in a different form to 2 of his followers who were walking from Jerusalem into the country. They rushed back to tell the others, but no one believed them. So yet again, eyewitnesses coming to the disciples saying, we have seen Jesus, he is risen from the dead, and the disciples all said, nope, don't believe it. But Thomas gets the bad rap. But really, let's look at what Thomas actually said, as opposed to, nope. Don't believe it. Thomas declared something entirely different than what is apparently a refusal to believe. So all the other disciples had eyewitnesses come to them saying, we have seen him with our own eyes. He is risen from the dead, and they refused to believe what they were being told. To paraphrase what Thomas said, I'm willing to believe if I can see some proof. That's very different than a refusal to believe. I'm just shutting it down. Nope, don't believe it. Thomas says, I'm willing, but I need some proof. Before I can go from Jesus on a cross, dead, buried in a tomb, to now alive again, before I can make that leap, I need to see proof. But he was willing to believe. That's very, very different than a refusal to believe. But back at the beginning of that passage, though, let's take a moment and talk about the fact Thomas wasn't with the other disciples the first time Jesus showed up. The first time Jesus appeared to those disciples after his resurrection, and Thomas isn't in the room. Of course, we don't know exactly why, but let's think about what we've learned about Thomas. He was pessimistic, sure. Worst case scenario is what's going to happen. Yeah, I kind of remember Jesus saying some stuff about, you know, he was going to be back or tear this temple down and I'll rebuild it in 3 days and all this other kind of stuff. And yeah, some people have shown up saying they've seen him, but I haven't. They must be mistaken. It's got to be somebody else. They're wrong. So he's got that pessimistic viewpoint. He's also now experiencing what he really envisioned to be the worst case scenario for Thomas. He's away from Jesus. Jesus is gone. He's heartbroken. He's crushed. Without hope. It's done. It's over. Again, we don't know why he wasn't in that room, but it's very likely he couldn't bear to be around those other guys to constantly be reminded of everything he had lost. But let's really look at these other times where we've encountered Thomas and think through what has just now happened. At first, no, Jesus, you can't go there. You're going to be captured and executed. And then Thomas is the one who predicts, well, Jesus is going to die. And what happened? Jesus was captured and executed and died. The timing was a little different. The location was a little different. But what Thomas feared had happened. And then when Jesus says, you're going to know where I'm going to go. And he says, no, I don't know. I need to know where to find you. And now some women show up and say, Jesus isn't where we left him. He doesn't know where Jesus is. Now he's thinking, I don't even have a tomb that I can go weep at, go lay some flowers at, go visit the grave. Now I don't even have that. Absolute worst case scenario. His fears have come to fruition. Jesus was captured. Jesus was executed. And now he doesn't know where to find him. He doesn't know where Jesus is. It's easy to imagine that Thomas, who may very well have been the most sincere of them all, not wanting to be around the rest of those disciples. That constant reminder of what they had all hoped and envisioned that the Messiah was going to do. The last 2-3 years of his life are now gone. I mean, that's, of course, is a possibility. And we don't know for sure, but I think there's another possibility. I think all of that is obviously a contributing factor, but I think there's another explanation as well to just add to the story. If you go back to the moment when Jesus appeared that second time, the same circumstances he had before. But this time, Thomas is there with him. And again, Jesus doesn't rebuke Thomas, does he? He doesn't smack him around for wanting proof. Jesus doesn't even call him doubting Thomas. Thomas said, I'll believe it if I can get some proof. And what does Jesus do? Here you go. Here's the proof. Here's exactly what you need to believe. He demanded proof, and Jesus gave it to him. Jesus met Thomas exactly where Thomas was and gave him what he needed to continue on in faith, to continue on in his relationship with Jesus. Okay, I'm going to go off script a little bit because y'all know how much I just absolutely adore all those Hallmark card cliche sentimentalities when it comes to faith. You know, in real faith, there's no room for doubt. Shut up. Are you kidding me? Those are pithy little statements that are meant to dismiss our own issues. You know, because when we see somebody else that might be wrestling with a why question, with how could this possibly happen, we're feeling the same thing, but we try to reassure ourselves by dismissing other people's doubts. Well, real faith drives out all fear. Shut up. Sorry, is that not theological or spiritual or pastoral enough for me to stand up here with a microphone telling people who would dismiss other people's pain to shut up? But the reality of it is, we have to be completely, fully engaged in our faith. Heart, mind, soul, and strength. And if our mind can't understand something, that doesn't mean we get to just dismiss it with a cliche. Just like Thomas. He didn't dismiss those questions. He wrestled with them, and he brought them out. And Jesus didn't smack him down for it. Jesus showed up and said, you need proof? Okay, here it is. Here's the proof that you need. But even in Jesus' response, there's a clue to what's really going on in Thomas's heart. It's found, actually, if you drill down into the Greek, to the tense of the verb that Jesus uses when communicating to Thomas. It doesn't come out in the English very well, but in John 20, verse 27, when Jesus says, don't be faithless any longer, believe. What Jesus literally said, and this is in the Greek verb tense, and I've said it before, Greek is such a descriptive language where every word means something very, very, very specific. And even the tense of the word, the framing, the context means something. And what Jesus literally said is, stop becoming an unbeliever and become a believer. Stop becoming an unbeliever. Stop looking for reasons to not believe. Just believe. Start looking for reasons to believe. Stop trying to become an unbeliever. Now, do I think Thomas was really actively searching for reasons to abandon his faith? No, I don't. But I think Jesus recognized that Thomas was starting to go down a road that so many people do when bad things happen. You start to drift away. Because we can't rationalize, how could a loving God allow such as this to occur? That's when a lot of people really start to wrestle with and question their faith. And then you get a well-meaning follower of Christ come along with a statement like, well, if you really had faith, you wouldn't be asking those questions. Instead, we need to wrestle with those questions. Bring them to Jesus. Bring them to the community of people. Let's wrestle with them together. I told myself I wasn't going to do this today because we've all been dealing with it all week, and I didn't want to bring it up again today. But almost everyone in this room knows what has been happening in Dayton School toward the end of this week. Choosing to look on the bright side and say that even in the midst of that, God is using that experience to bring kids and adults closer to Him in faith. And yes, I did get that question many times toward the end of this week. How could this happen? How can God let this happen? And instead of just trying to placate those questions, thank you, Jesus, for giving me the ability to engage with those questions and to help students wrestle with those questions. The bottom line is we live in a sin-sick, fallen world because God gave us the ability to choose. We can't love Him without choice. In order for us to truly love Him, He had to give us the ability to not love Him, because you can't have real love without choice. And just like everything else that involves people with a pulse, we're going to screw it up. So He gives us the ability to choose, and instead we're going to choose to bring hurt and pain to other people. Because we live in a sin-sick, fallen world where people have selfish hearts. But thank God there's an answer. There's hope. It can all be repaired. So a loving God had to give us the ability to choose to love Him. But that also means we can choose to not. And that's where pain comes in. Faith is a journey. But we're all not just traveling toward heaven and an eternity with God. Faith is a journey this side of heaven too, with lots of little rabbit trails that we can go off on and come back, and starts and stops and all sorts of things. It's a journey that we're on now, and it's a journey that can either lead us further into and deeper into a relationship with God beyond salvation, but right here and right now, or it's a journey that can take us away. And I genuinely, firmly believe that if we were all a little more like Thomas, we would all be able to keep our bearings on that path a whole lot better than if we just nodded our heads and went along with what we didn't understand or didn't even agree with. All of our faiths will be made a whole lot stronger if we engage with those questions. If we engage our doubts. And I absolutely love Thomas's response. My Lord and my God. There is no more profound declaration of who Jesus is than that statement right there. In all of Scripture, there is no more profound declaration about Jesus than doubting Thomas's words. None of the other disciples came close, not even Peter. Not even Peter. When people said, when Jesus asked, who do the people say I am? And he said, well, you're the Messiah. Not even that. That pales in comparison to doubting Thomas's bold declaration, my Lord and my God. And yeah, it took Jesus showing up saying, put your finger right here to get him there, but he got there. And Jesus will prove things to us too. If we bring our doubts to him, we bring our questions to him. Bring the why questions, bring the how questions. Thomas's story really influences our followership of Jesus in a couple of ways. And the first is simply this. If you tend to view the world through pessimistic eyes, I want to challenge you to please pray for a change of perspective. I mean, I know that I can be annoyingly Pollyanna-ish at times. It's such a better perspective than an Eeyore, you know, thanks for noticing me, everything sucks mentality. And I've said from here before in this conversation I've had just a few weeks ago with somebody about, well, but aren't you motivated by negative? Don't you always say you're motivated by negative? Absolutely. 100%, I am. I'm one of those twisted, demented people that always will look for the faults. But a pessimistic person dwells on them. I find the faults because I know it can be better. That's how we improve. That's how we build it stronger and better, as we find what's not working and find the silver lining to that cloud. Make it better. I no way, shape, or form am I going to say that being optimistic is going to prevent calamity or difficulty in our lives. Absolutely not. That's ridiculous. But how we view difficulty, how we view challenges in our life, how we view the calamity really does make a statement about where we place our trust, our faith, and how we can influence other people around us. But above all else, I believe Thomas shows us that in our faith, it's okay to question. It's okay to have doubts. It's okay. No one, I don't care how many degrees in theology they have, no one on this side of eternity has all the answers. We don't. There are some things we won't know until we see Jesus face to face. And then it's all going to make sense. I was sitting in the back having a conversation with somebody just this morning about the events of this last week. And even with what was happening in the school and the conversations that were being had and all that stuff, you can already start to see how somehow God is turning this toward positive outcomes. And that's no disrespect, not minimizing nothing that the family or the closest friends of that young man are going through. But God is capable of more than we can ever ask or imagine. And because He can do more with anything than we can ever ask or imagine, that means we're not going to know how He does it. I don't know how He does that. But I know He does. I mean, I wish I could tell you, show you the blueprint. This is exactly how God turns everything for our good and for His glory. But I don't know. That's why He's God and I'm not. But what I know is that in even the most tragic circumstances, He will find more ways than I can even possibly dream of. All of us collectively together, putting our collective brain power to work, we still can't come up with all of the different ways that God will turn beauty from or turn ashes to beauty. But He does. I truly believe. You know, throughout this series, I've said it a couple times, we all start to identify with certain disciples more. Oh, I see a lot of Peter in myself, or, you know, John or any of these guys. I truly believe the one that every single one of us has the most in common with is Thomas. Every single one of us. If we're sincere about it. If we follow His lead. Be sincere, open, honest about our questions. The things that we don't understand. And yes, I know, because we all have a pulse in this room, I know every single one of us at some point in time has needed some proof. Yes, we can accept some things on faith. The most transformational experience I had, the reason why I'm standing on this platform with a microphone right now, is because when a dark moment came and I was very, very new in this whole Jesus thing, I demanded proof because it just wasn't working. So clearly, the fault is on God's side. Of course it is. I demanded proof from him. I won't even tell you what happened. The results, I think, probably speak for themselves as to what happened. If you are in a place where you're not sure about something, I want you on bended knee demanding proof from God. Because I'm pretty sure he ain't going to pull out the smite button just for you for doing that. Experience tells me he's going to prove it in a way that is absolutely unmistakable, that he is exactly who he says he is, and that your faith is extremely well placed. So yes, your pastor just stood up here at a microphone and gave you marching orders. Take every single one of your doubts and your questions straight to the feet of Jesus, and yes, boldly demand proof. There you go. Thou art authorized to question Jesus. But do it with an open heart and let him prove it to you. Don't be like the other disciples who refuse to believe. Be like Thomas. I'll believe if. I'm willing to, but I gotta see it. And then let him amaze you. Because I'm 100% sure he will. So God, thank you. Thank you for all of the times and for all of the ways that you have already proven to us that you are good, that you love us, that you are capable and willing to do more than we can ever ask or imagine. And so, Holy Spirit, I ask that you would clear away any of the fog from our eyes, any of the fog from our hearts that would keep us from seeing and perceiving all of the different ways in which you are keeping every single promise that you have made. Because God, we're human. Though we may try to deny our questions, though we may try to dismiss our doubts, we're not fooling you. You know exactly where each and every heart within the sound of my voice is at. And so please help every single one of us to strip away the wax and be sincere, to be open, to be honest with you. And I know that you will prove it. I know that where we need evidence and proof, that you will provide. Because I know that you want nothing more than our entire life and devotion, our love for you, a relationship with you. So you're not going to turn us away simply because we have questions. Instead, you're going to answer those questions. Where proof is needed, you're going to provide proof. God, I know that. I trust that. I've experienced that. So, Holy Spirit, have your way within each one of us, showing us where we need more of you, where we need more of your answers, where we need more proof, so that we can honestly and sincerely and steadfastly go through every single day for the rest of our lives with hope that even though dark times come, you can do more than we can ask or imagine. You will bring beauty from ashes in ways that we can't even understand. But you will continue to lead us and show us that you always have more in store for us. So God, I ask that you continue to heal the wounds in this community, God. I ask that you continue to bring comfort and peace to those most affected in our community right now. And above all else, God, I ask that you use even this to bring honor and glory to your Son, Jesus, and more people into relationship with him. And God, let all of us, if we have a role to play in that transformation of people's lives toward faith in you, we trust you're going to equip and empower us to do just that. Let every single one of us always live our lives for your honor and for your glory. In Jesus' name, amen.